evening. It is Friday, January 17th, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It's Friday, and that means it's panel time. So we're going to kick this off with my first guests. First, he's a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Mopp. And Caleb, as always, welcome back.
Sure. Glad to be here, as always.
And we are also joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. He's the author of the new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Well, we got to start with the story that's consuming the news. A Senate impeachment trial begins with rancor over witnesses and new evidence about Trump's Ukraine dealings. This is the third impeachment trial in the history of the United States. It officially began yesterday amid a swirl of new allegations about President Trump's dealings with Ukraine, which several Republicans rushed to downplay as they dismissed Democrats' calls for further investigation. Caleb, a gentleman by the name of Lev Parnas, a former associate of Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, has alleged that Trump knew of his role in the effort to dig up dirt in Ukraine, that this could benefit the president politically. Are these new allegations making it tougher for Mitch McConnell to hold his line?
I don't think so. I think that we are proceeding with what is at this point almost an exercise or a work of performance art. I mean, this is the Democrats making a point of making Donald Trump the third president in U.S. history to face impeachment. This is Donald Trump making the point that he is the victim of a vast deep state conspiracy to stop his great plan to make America great again. And, you know, they're both getting some political benefit out of it, and they're going through the motions, and it'll be some theater on Capitol Hill. But I don't think that much is going to change. I don't expect a wild card to be thrown in that could make this really change very much. I think this is just kind of a continuation of the reality TV show in the White House, and it'll be going to Capitol Hill, and that's what we're dealing with.
Jack, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, said blocking the military assistance to Ukraine violated a law that limits a president's power to withhold money allocated by Congress. They said the White House's Office of Management and Budget, OMB, violated the Impoundment Control Act when it withheld nearly $400 million for, quote, a policy reason, end quote, even though the funds had been allocated by Congress. The decision was directed by the president himself, and during the House impeachment inquiry, administration officials testified that they had raised concerns about its legality to no avail. Of course, the administration disagrees with GAO's findings. Your thought to this, as well as to the first question, are these allegations making it tougher for McConnell to hold his line?
Well, regarding the last one, you know, probably, you know, it's true that this thing would just proceed. sort of a choreographed show here for both sides. However, I'm not totally committed to that perspective. Once you get witnesses here, it's unknown what will happen. And, you know, we apparently have at least two Republicans that have appeared to break ranks on allowing witnesses. You know, Snow there in Maine, and I think the North Dakota senator, I forgot his name, are sort of indicating they're willing to have witnesses. Should there be witnesses, then it's harder to not allow documents. Who knows what's going to happen should that. Well, I mean, one thing that probably will happen to Republicans will really drive witnesses, probably call Hunter Biden Jr. there, you know, and who knows where all this leads. I don't know that the Democrats are going to really want someone like Biden Jr. there. You know, it would upset their prime Democrat leadership candidate there, Joe Biden. So it's a big unknown, you know, lots could happen here. We we shouldn't rule out the possibility. And I think that's what the Democrats are rolling the dice on, that somehow the evidence will force four of these Republicans to change their tune and allow witnesses. You know, the Republican defense against this is, oh, look, you Democrats were supposed to have all the witnesses and all the evidence here in the House impeachment. All we do is rule on the existing information you provide us, that we're not supposed to go ahead and bring in new witnesses and documents and so forth, which means it's not really a trial, right, in the Republicans' view. Then it's a constitutional question. Is it really a trial? The Constitution says tried. It's a trial. Trials have evidence. Trials have witnesses, you know. But the Republicans say, no, it's not really a trial. We'll see. It's just another example of constitutional crisis. As far as the second question is concerned, way back in the 70s, Nixon impounded all kind of congressional funds allocated for spending. But he was defeated in that eventually and had to release it. So there's a precedent that you can't impound funds. That's what Trump did with this allocation of defense funds to go to Ukraine. Of course, he backed off of that. So you could argue, well, he didn't really. It's not an issue anymore. But, it's interesting to me that the GAO would rule on this. Which is probably true. It probably is illegal. Well, wouldn't it also be illegal for Trump to divert funds allocated by Congress, particularly for defense?
One has to wonder that.
Yeah. And I mean, these are cracks in the constitutional edifice that are going on here in the U.S. Certainly the diversion to his wall of funds is as great an illegal act as impounding temporarily the funds for Ukraine. It's part of the constitutional crisis, which is going to creep here further, I predict, throughout 2020. But that's an important development, I think, although I don't think that by itself would shake Mitch McConnell, carrying Trump's water here, as they say, in the Senate. But let's see what happens. This thing could open up, if you you have witnesses.
So Lev Parnas said he arrived for his May meeting in Kiev with a top aide to Ukraine's president-elect Volodymyr Zelensky with a clear directive from Giuliani that unless Zelensky announced an investigation into Biden. And this is now starting to stain the garments of Vice President Pence. Caleb, has Lev Parnas become the new Cohen? He's a former close associate of Trump's, whom Trump now disavows. He's a pretty dirty guy who the press now is making their interview du jour. Is he becoming the new Cohen?
You know, that is kind of a pattern we've seen over the course of Trump's presidency so far, is that when somebody who works for him is caught in some wrongdoing, he just kind of disavows them, washes his hands of them, and just kind of turns against them. And that's an on here. It makes you wonder if Trump is the kind of person you work for, right? I mean, that's not exactly, behavior. You would think that that Trump would stand by his own team and all of that. But I guess if you're involved in things that are potentially scandalous, you can't particularly do that. We shall see how the impeachment trial proceeds, and we shall see. I mean, that we're just going to have to see how this ultimately pans out. But I really predict that the votes will go down pretty much along party lines, and that despite new revelations, there will be Republicans who don't want to remove Trump. There will be Democrats who do. And this will all kind of move forward and people will get the political benefit they want out of it, mainly with their base. I don't think people in the middle are particularly moved by this, but Trump's base will see that Trump is under attack and fighting the deep state, as they put it. And, it'll feed into Trump's kind of persecution complex. And for Democrats, who hate Donald Trump, it'll look like the Democrats are strong and doing something and being tough. And, you know, we can all just kind of move on. I think that at this point, that's almost a foregone conclusion. Unless things really dramatically shift, unless some of these revelations do, you know, bring in some information that could potentially really change things. But even then, right, I mean, let's remember that voting not to remove President Donald Trump is not the same as saying he did nothing wrong, right?
Right.
We know about the possibility of a censure and such like that. And I think there may be many Republicans who say, well, Trump did something wrong here. He clearly didn't act appropriately, but we don't want to remove him from office. And that may become more the position of Republicans if new evidence surfaces.
In fact, Caleb, really the crux of my question there to what you've just said is I seriously doubt that the president is going to be removed from office. But really what I'm looking at now with these newest developments, the drip, drip, drip of these developments is there now any way that the Democrats can turn what many professed to be a failed move into a political success, damaging the president going into 2020?
I mean, it's possible, but I just think in terms of public relations, this Zelensky story is way, way too complicated. Mm-hmm. I must tell you, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, how many people are going to vote now? Who do I vote for at the poll, the Democrat or President Trump? Well, there was this guy in Ukraine and he was on the phone with a guy and he said to not send some money. And it's like, whoa, you lost me there. Okay. Yeah. I really don't think this is the kind of thing that's going to affect an average voter. I'm sorry.
Jack, I've been saying all along that the Democrats have been engaging in a circumstantial case. And we know in courts of law that circumstantial evidence can at times be more damning than direct evidence. But here, we're not in a court of law, we're in the court of public opinion. And so in the court of public opinion, to move someone off of their position, you need more than circumstantial, because people are going to interpret these realities in whatever is most advantageous to their position. Jack Rasmus.
I agree. I don't think he's going to be convicted, probably because it's too damn close to the election.
Mm-hmm.
None of these senators are going to want to pull the plug when there's only, 8 or 9 months left. And that alone mitigates against a conviction, I think. They'll just let it go. It will be... a PR event, you know, as you said, for both sides. Look, you know, the U.S. electorate is really polarized. Of course, that's not a revelation. Everyone knows that. But you've got 30%, 30-40% on both ends here that, are just going to say hooray for our side, depending on what evidence comes up. And in the middle, you got maybe 10-20%. And, I think they're going to public opinion there won't change very much unless there's such a dramatic revelation forthcoming.
Right. Gotcha.
It's not likely. I don't think the middle is going to change that much. They're going to say, well, you know, it's only 8 months. Let's just vote this guy out one way or another. So it's mostly a PR event. And of course, you got, you know, Fox News and Breitbart lined on one end and, MSDNC on the other end. And CNN, et cetera. So it's going to be an interesting educational event. And the partisan thing, I think, is an effort to make it look more like the Nixon event. You know, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and now you got Barr, Mulvaney, and so forth. You know, it's obviously a play to make it look much like that. But nowhere in your wildest dreams will Donald Trump ever resign?
Right.
No matter what, unlike Nixon, no matter what the evidence is. And of course, you know, he's got a Supreme Court in his pocket. You know, why should he if it has to come to that? And he's got a base, an active base out there. And he's got Mitch McConnell, in his other pocket. He's threatened pardons and so forth. Particularly, you'll see a pardon if it comes to it for Giuliani, I'm sure. He's got a lot of cards to play, and he's not the kind of guy who gives in at all.
I'm sorry to jump in here, but we're running out of time, and I want to get to your piece about Trump's feeble phase one China deal. You mentioned he has the Supreme Court in his pocket going out on this. It just is interesting to me. We'll see how John Roberts plays in all of this, and if there are actually any substantive issues or issues of consequence for John Roberts to determine, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Jack, you've written a piece, Trump's Feeble Phase One China-U.S. Trade Deal, wherein you ask, what do we see in the much-hyped and grossly exaggerated Phase One U.S.-China trade deal? Your thoughts, Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, I mean, if you look behind the bombast and the hyperbole and all the lies even of what's going on, what's in this deal, you see there's not very much there at all. You know, first of all, look at the major provisions that Trump says he's achieved, right? 51% ownership for U.S. companies in China, particularly the banks, really wanted that. Well, China offered that 2 years ago, and it's already begun implementing it with European banks, and I think even Goldman Sachs now is setting up majority ownership. Currency manipulation. Well, that's a big farce. China, in the last 5-6 years, has done just the opposite. It's intervened in money markets to stabilize its currency, not devalue it. So all this claim by Trump that, they got protection against currency manipulation is an outright lie. China's not a currency manipulator, just the opposite. IP and tech transfer. Well, you know, even the director of international economics for the Council of Foreign Relationships says, came out here just a few days before and pretty much said, quote, China is set to do little more than restore agricultural purchases and offer some nice words on financial services and intellectual property. Trump could have had that 2 years ago without the tariff damage. You know, that kind of summarizes the whole essence of this deal. And particularly if you look at the falsifications behind all these claims of $200 billion in farm and other purchases. First of all, China has not agreed to that in an absolute sense. It's it's a target for China. And China has said, Louis, their chief negotiator, has said that, hey, look, it depends on Chinese demand and other market conditions. In other words, if you want to keep $370 billion in tariff, Donald, we're not going to really fulfill that. And if you look behind the scenes, and those who have read it, the thing is not in the deal is not in English yet. But if those who have read it, there's only $32 billion, $16 billion a year in new farm purchases. And that means $16 billion on top of the $24 billion that was the level of farm purchases by China before the trade war. So $40 billion is really only $16 billion new. And it's only a two-year agreement, so 16 and 16 is $32 billion. That will just about make up the reduction in farm purchases by China over the last 2 years. So they're just restoring what they were, and that will depend on market conditions, So it's a big, big exaggeration what's actually going on here. And the other areas of purchases and services and manufacturing are, also overinflated for various reasons. What is interesting is they agree to buy more natural gas, $27 billion in more natural gas, because the U.S. has such a glut. It's trying to force this natural gas on everybody around the world. and most important, $370 billion in tariffs will still remain in phase two. But there will be no substantive phase two. The trade war is over with China. China and Europe and no one else is going to agree to any changes. They'll sit down and negotiate and discuss, but nothing further is going to be achieved here in terms of trade relations restructuring before the election. They're all going to wait them out. Phase two will just be a lot of talk. And phase two is really about the tech war that I've talked about before. And it's holding the tariffs to force a change in technology by China, and China's simply not going to do it. And when you look at, really the effects of this, the economic effects of this trade war, it's kind of been, you know, really negative here after 22 months. You know, what do we see? We see $42 billion cost the business, 100% transfer, according to the New York Federal Reserve Bank, of the cost of an price increases on the on households and consumers. All right, business confidence investing has collapsed. It's cost households $806 on average here in spending power. You know, you you know, multiply that times 130 million households, and that's quite a bit in spending power. And finally, the farm sector is has been ravaged, particularly small and medium farmers. You know, we have a 6-year high in farm loan delinquency, 8-year high in Chapter 12 farm bankruptcies, the continuing decline in farm income, except for the big agribusiness boys. And he spent $28 billion in subsidies on this, and he's going to have to spend more before the election.
He spent he spent a whole lot to get nothing. Is basically
well, that's what the CFR of all sources. You know, this is the big capitalist think tank, Council of Foreign Relations, represents you know, the traditional mainstream wing of the capitalist class here. You know, they're saying you know, we're glad it's over, but boy, it sure hasn't produced very much. You know, a lot of smoke and mirrors, a lot of bombast, and it's even worse for all his other trade deals. Nothing here, nothing.
Caleb, your thoughts, especially from the perspective of, if this was such a big deal and such a great accomplishment, why didn't President Xi come to Washington to sign it? Or why wasn't this signed somewhere in a middle ground country, or why didn't Trump go to China if this was such a big deal?
Indeed. I mean, we saw the vice premier, Liu He, we saw him there. And I think if you look at the Chinese press and what the Chinese press has been saying really from day one of this trade war, is that they realize that Donald Trump is using this as a political football, right? He wants to say that he fought China, he stood up to China, he's the great negotiator. He got a better deal. He played hardball. He stood up to the Chinese. He's protecting American jobs. He's making America great again. And China realizes this. They realize that much. And they don't want to go along with it. That's really essentially what's happening here. And there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and there's a lot of bombast. And if you look at actual, you know, phase one, right? I mean, tariffs aren't even being lifted at this point, right? The tariffs that have been imposed are remaining in effect, and some tariffs that have already been scheduled are going to continue, but some of them are being lessened. It's really phase two when anything happens. Like, nothing has happened here. I mean, this is, you know, and if you watched that ceremony where Trump was just going on and on about it and thanking every big name. Thank you, Henry Kissinger, and thank you, Sheldon Adelson, and thank you, you know, Robert Lighthizer, and thank, I mean, he's going on and on like it was an awards show or something. Again, lots of smoke and mirrors, and there's not much there. There's really not much there, and I think that that's China's doing. I think China says, look, okay, Trump, you know, you're starting a trade war. This fits your rhetoric. This fits your political strategy. And we are going to try to play along with this as little as we possibly can. We don't want to aid you in using the global markets and bombast and threats of the trade war to help your reelection campaign. I think that's what's going on there. And I did want to mention, you know, earlier Dr. Jack Rasmus mentioned the Nixon administration. And I think that this is a weird, weird pattern that we have seen with the Trump administration and even some other recent presidencies in U.S. history. There's this weird desire to somehow reenact or replay aspects of the Trump of the Nixon White House. I mean, it's very, very bizarre. We saw Trump on the campaign trail saying he's the law and order candidate, that he speaks for the silent majority. We know where that rhetoric came from. That's Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign. Of course, right? You know, I mean, all of this stuff, it's very, very odd. And it's a very, very odd trend. But we saw it, I think, even before. You go back to 2004, the Bush-Kerry election. The whole thing was about, you know, Vietnam, and John Kerry fought in Vietnam, and was he honest about his record? And And it's this weird thing. It's like you think that like the period, you know, 1968 to 1972, when this country was in like political turmoil. And it seems like for a lot of the people that are now in government, like, you know, senior government officials, that is like the eternal point of reference. You know, that period where you had, you know, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King and urban rebellions in the United States, the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, Richard Nixon coming into office, the FBI cracking down on the Black Liberation Movement. All of this stuff, you know, it seems to have been kind of the point of reference. Like that was the period in which the generation that is now, you know, running American government, they saw how to get things done during that period. And everything is kind of measured in relation to that period. It's very, very strange. I mean, even this China stuff, as we were discussing, for example, I mean, what is Nixon very, very famous for is, you know,
opening China.
Went to China. Right. And we see Trump, not only Trump is, you know, dealing with China and making a big deal out of the fact that he can deal with China. We saw Trump also, you know, going to North Korea and, you know, doing a photo op. And again, it's like you have to wonder, is this just Trump or is this the entire political establishment? This kind of fixation on a very short period in U.S. history that was very, very full of political turmoil and confusion. And I have to wonder what this is all about. But the reality is, you know, 1968 to 1972 was a time of great political turmoil in the United States, but it was also a booming economy at that point. I mean, the economy was doing very, very, very well at that point compared to what it is now. The wages and the living standards of the average American worker were far higher than they are today. And so the context of the political debate was very, very, very different. And the character of the United States, demographics have changed a whole lot since then. You know, Richard Nixon, when he talked about the silent majority, many understood that to be a racial statement. He was talking about, you know, the white and middle class and all of that. But things have changed in the United States. I mean, mm-hmm. the demographics have changed. The country has changed. The way people see things has changed. So it's not like you can just apply things that were said and transplant them to now, you know, 50 years later. I mean, you just can't do it. So what is going on here? I mean, there's an expression, they say, generals fight the last war. And I feel like that's going on from all sides. I mean, Trump is being fought by people who are fighting, you know, Nixon. Trump is trying to be Nixon. It's very, very interesting.
Trump is trying to be Nixon, not only with his forays into or with China, but impeachment as well. Even though Nixon was not impeached. There are more parallels than we care. Hey, we need to pause here. Caleb Maupin, as always, thank you so much for your insight and your time. Jack, stay with me. Folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. It's Friday. It's panel time. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and Dr. Jack Rasmus is staying with us. Jack, thank you very much. We're also joined by a political analyst and commentator, editor of The Polemicist. His latest piece can be found at Counterpunch and The Polemicist. It is entitled Impeachment, What Lies Beneath Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And the journalist, author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Tuesday, we had a whittled down field of Democratic presidential candidates. They focused their shared disdain for President Trump. They elaborated on a host of policy differences, domestic and foreign, in the Iowa presidential debate, whose most animated moment turned on whether a woman could become president, according to Senator Bernie Sanders. Were there any valuable takeaways from Tuesday night's debate, Jim Kavanaugh?
They clearly learned that CNN is in the tank against Warren, against Bernie Sanders, not necessarily for Warren to last night, but they're out to get Bernie Sanders. And that was one of the most disgraceful performances by a debate moderating team I've ever seen. I think anybody's ever seen. We've learned that Elizabeth Warren has, in trying to stab Bernie in the back, stabbed herself, cut her own throat, and is pretty much guaranteed she's not going to win the Democratic nomination. And, you know, it was quite a lesson in how the media can, in bias is too weak a word for it. The media can just turn everything into an attack on someone. And it wasn't just Elizabeth Warren. All the questions to Bernie and all the questions about Bernie were just really framed in such a way as to, you know, why are you going to bankrupt the country? And then Joe Biden, why is Bernie Sanders going to bankrupt the country? I mean, it was really just an incredible display of, what can I say, bias, media bias and media. What we're seeing is what Bernie Sanders is going to face the further along he gets to the nomination, because the establishment media from CNN to the right wing, certainly, although they've been quite kinder to him now, are going to come after him.
Daniel Lazar, to Jim's point, interesting that after the row on Tuesday night, that Bernie Sanders' poll numbers went up, as well as contributions to the Sanders campaign. This, to me, really was a mess. And to Jim's point, Abby Phillip, I think, just did a horrific job with the way that she, after Bernie was very, very clear in saying, no, I never said that, she turns to Elizabeth Warren and says, how did you feel after Bernie said it? Daniel Lazar.
Oh, no, it was amazing. I mean, Jim is absolutely right. It was just completely outrageous. I've never seen anything as quite as bad as that. And that's saying a great deal, because CNN is, you know, it has been outrageous for a long time, but this is even worse. But, you know, we were expecting an effort to zap Sanders. I mean, Sanders has been rising very strongly in the last two or three weeks. And clearly the media, the establishment, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, was not going to put up with it and was looking for a way to ambush him. And what this reminds me of is the way the British press just hit Corbyn repeatedly over the anti-Semitism issue. It was completely phony, totally concocted. Yet Corbyn was put in a position where he really couldn't say no. So he couldn't really rebut it. So now Sanders is being accused of being a sexist, and there's really little he can do that won't convince, you know, his most ardent critics that he is not beating his wife and never has beat his wife. So it's completely outrageous. But you know, we knew they were going to try to get Sanders at some point, and now they have.
Jack Rasmus, early on, up to this last Iowa debate, it was amazing to me how, when you'd watch CNN or MSNBC, the polling numbers that they would use were old, were wrong. They seemed to be doing a lot of things to not have to admit that Senator Sanders is doing as well in the public eye as he's doing. And then we see what transpired in Iowa this past Tuesday night. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I agree with the prior comments here that this is the launching of the attack on Sanders. Clearly, Democratic leadership and their media here, which is CNN, MSNBC, that's why we call it MSDNC, the Democratic National Committee, clearly had planned all this. I mean, someone writes up these questions and coaches the moderators how to deliver them. And I think it's really a plan to get the left wing here, Warren and Sanders, mutually destroying each other, going after each other. This is, an attempt not just on Sanders, but to sort of put down the left wing, make him look like it's just a personality clash and so forth. This is well orchestrated, and it's the beginning of the attack on Sanders. And we're going to see a lot worse. Most folks don't realize what happened in 2016 what the Democratic Party leadership did to Sanders at that time. I mean, there's good evidence he probably won some of these primaries that he was denied. We're going to see more of this because the Democratic Party leadership strategy is the strategy revealed in 2018, which is to go after fringe suburbanites and exurbanites, middle class, women, intellectuals, military vets, and so forth. And they think because they won a majority that way in the House that strategy will play on a national scale as well for the president election. I think they're grossly misunderstanding what's going on. And while they want to go that route, the leadership, Bernie wants to go the route of let's mobilize all those disaffected people who have given up on the Democratic Party, including workers in some places, and bring them back in. And it looks like, Bernie might prevail with that strategy, but they'll never let Bernie get the nomination. People should understand that it will never happen, no matter what, how many primaries he wins. That's why they've got Bloomberg there. You know, the whole strategy is to prevent the left wing in the party from getting a majority have a brokered convention in which Bloomberg or maybe Buttigieg or maybe both of them, it's like alternative one, alternative two, will step up and get the nomination.
You know, one of the things, Jim Kavanaugh, that I found, and I'm hoping at some point Jack just, it becomes more definitive in what he thinks about where Bernie will fall in this. Jack, I hope sometime you can, let us know really where you are with this. But Jim, one of the things that a lot of people wondered after Tuesday night was what would happen to Bernie Sanders as it relates to women. And so far, from what the numbers are showing, from what I've read, is that the support remains unchanged among women, about 15% supporting Sanders, 11% supporting Warren. So that puts you right almost right there in the margin of error, assuming a 3% plus or minus. But I found that to be, some folks thought there'd be this huge swing of women away from Bernie, but the dust seems to be settling and Bernie's standing where he was standing before.
Yeah, I think most people saw through this. There's going to be a small segment that's going to be militantly, oh yeah, we got to believe everything that Elizabeth Warren says. But Elizabeth Warren has no credibility for decades. She was a Native American. She's the first woman of color. She's been fudging the truth at the very least for decades. So she's a person who comes into this with, a propensity to dissemble or deceive. And Bernie has an absolutely clear record about this. There's no credibility to the idea that he said a woman couldn't. He tried to get her to run for president. He was going to back away so that if she was going to run in 2016. So it's really disgraceful. And then they've tried to repeat what they did, actually. It was very interesting. She slid the question from did he say this or didn't he say this to, well, let's talk about the issue of whether a woman could run for president. And now all the headlines are the Democrats are wrapped up in this debate about whether a woman can run for or can win the presidency. Nobody, literally nobody, said a woman can't win the presidency. Everybody on that stage said a woman can win the presidency. But somehow it's become that debate that she represents the good side of, and somebody supposedly is out there saying the opposite when actually nobody is. So they've replaced what is the real issue, that for that moment, which was who's credible here, Bernie or Elizabeth, with a fake, totally fake issue. Are people saying is it possible for a woman to win the presidency or not? It's a fake debate. There's no debate about it. So really, it's all an attempt. And as you say, I mean, most women aren't fooled by this. In fact, they're insulted by it. And a lot of people on Facebook were like, "Oh, my mother was a Warren supporter, but after this, she sent a contribution to Bernie." I mean, this isn't going to go over. And you saw the polls; he rose in the polls, and as you say, got like a 1.7 million donors that night. So it's going to hurt Warren. But what it's doing, the idea is to put enough cuts on Bernie, small cuts, to keep his delegate count below the majority when he goes to the convention, because as Jack says, they're not going to let him win.
And Jimmy Dore, the commentator and comedian Jimmy Dore said, who are you going to believe, Bernie or Pocahontas?
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty clever.
Hiawatha is another one. But anyway.
Yeah. Switching gears here. Senior administration officials struggle to explain intelligence behind the killing of General Soleimani. Senior administration officials declined Sunday to confirm President Trump's assertion that four U.S. embassies had been targeted for attack by Iran, while saying that Trump's interpretation of the threat was consistent with overall intelligence that justified the assassination. They're really having trouble getting their lies together, Daniel Lazar.
Yes, they are having a hard time coordinating their lies. You're quite correct.
The problem is the U.S. has gotten itself into such a ball of confusion in the Persian Gulf, it doesn't know what to do. Most of the Persian Gulf oil now goes to the Far East. A growing portion goes to China, America's growing rival. Yet the U.S. feels that for reasons of global hegemony, it must control Persian Gulf oil, even though the U.S. actually uses very little Persian Gulf oil these days. So the U.S. doesn't know why it's there. Its presence is radically destabilizing. The risk is growing ever more dramatically. The U.S. doesn't know what to do to stabilize things. And so, therefore, Trump, you know, sort of like you said, so, okay, since there's nothing rational we can do, we may as well just do the most irrational thing possible, and that is, you know, knock off Qassem Soleimani. So that's what he did. It was the ultimate sort of crazy act. Now, I don't know how far Trump wants to take this, but he gives every indication of just wanting to continually up the insanity. And so, therefore, it just seems that the confrontation between the U.S. and Iran can only continue. And by the way, the Iranian strike on the on one of the air bases, Al-Asad Air Base, was a very impressive demonstration of missile technology. The missiles were very powerful and they were very accurate. So the message to the U.S. is like, you know, you've got to think twice. But Trump can't think twice, because if he thinks twice, he wouldn't be in the Persian Gulf in the first place. So he just has got to see his behavior is growing more and more erratic, and he seems to have left no way for himself to back down.
Jack Rasmus, to Daniel's point, has Trump found himself stuck in the middle behind the financial interests in this country and the war interests in this country?
Well, those are, you know, two main factions here within the U.S. Capitalist class, and you can see them contend with each other in the China trade negotiations. You know, I don't think Trump is all that stupid. I really don't. I think there's a method here. But to understand what Trump is doing in the Middle East, you got to understand Trump is all about Trump, which is all about getting elected. What's going on is all about the domestic elections here in the United States. Trump has to have some foreign policy, quote, win, make him look tough for his base in the election. He has no foreign policy wins at all after 3 years, including the trade wars, you know, and this is all about the elections. He wants to keep this pot really boiling. And as I've said before, with Iran, he's got a formula in which Iran is between a rock and a hard place. If he accelerates his intimidation and provocations, and Iran doesn't take the bait or just, you know, doesn't escalate, well, then he looks like he wins to his base. He's tough. And if Iran really goes off the rails and escalates in kind, you know, justification, then, you know, he can go ahead and really intensify the military response, bypass the War Powers Act, put all this impeachment behind him and look really tough to his base. So I think this is all about elections, and he will keep this pot boiling up until the election. And the smartest thing I think the Iranians could do would be to agree to sit down with him and don't agree to a damn thing and wait him out. You know, it's going to be hard for him to provoke if negotiations are underway. But, you know, that's just my view, and it may be incorrect when you're intimidated like that to, you know, simply sit down with your adversary. But I see that as a way that Trump might be neutralized until November. You know,
Then we'll see.
Yeah, Iranians are going to wait him out. You know, they're not going to agree to anything, and he's not going to get anything. But as long as he can keep the pot boiling with these provocations, it's a win-win for him.
Jim Kavanaugh, to Daniel's point, the response was more impressive than folks anticipated, and now it's being reported 11 troops were wounded in the missile strike, reversing assurances of no injuries. We were told that no Americans were harmed in last night's attack. This was, of course, right after the attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases. That's according to the president right after the attack. It wouldn't surprise me if in another week or so we hear that there were deaths along with these injuries. Your thoughts, Jim Kavanaugh?
Yeah, we're all kidding ourselves. We've got to stop not looking at the problem here. What's driving this offensive against Iran is the same thing that drove it against Iraq and Libya and Syria, and it's Israel's interests. It's Israel's wanting to have absolute military hegemony in the Middle East, to be able to strike militarily wherever it wants with impunity. Iran is putting up resistance to that. That's what those ballistic missiles augur for Israel. The ones that hit the Saudi, that the Houthis have, that hit the Saudi oil facility with pinpoint accuracy. And these ones, which, as you say, if you look at the satellite pictures, they hit buildings on that base with pinpoint accuracy. And buildings where American soldiers were billeted, they had given a prior notification indirectly, so they weren't, most of them weren't there, but there were injuries, okay? And what you have is, and Donald Trump is not doing this to get reelected. This is going to hurt his reelected chances. Donald Trump was excoriated because he withheld striking Iran after they downed the drone missile, because he withheld striking Iran after the Houthis hit Saudi Arabia. And people like Pence and Bolton, who's out of it, but he's part of it. But Pompeo, the Christian Zionist, Pompeo says Donald Trump came to power in order to as an instrument of God to save Israel from Iran. And the Israelis today, yesterday, in the Christian Science Monitor, can Trump manage a Mideast crisis? Why Israelis have concerns? You can go back years, 2,000 word articles in the New York Times about how Netanyahu for years has been trying to get the United States to strike Iran. It's Israel that wants to strike on Iran, and they want it, and they're going to try and get it from the United States. And fortunately, Trump is impetuous. He does one thing one day, one thing another day, so they don't trust him to go forward with this because he doesn't. He watches Tucker Carlson, and he says, oh, I won't do it, which is bizarre. But anyway, what I'm saying is, if we don't get the idea that the primary driver of this business in the Middle East is Israel, and that is.
Well, I disagree. It's the election, stupid.
Having a war in the Middle East is not going to help Trump win the election. If everybody, every president who's won an election has won, they were lying about it. Oh, well, I'm going to stop the war. I'm going to take us out of war. And this, including Trump.
Now, following on to this, Iran rejects idea of a new, quote, Trump deal, end quote, in nuclear skirmish. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani dismissed on Wednesday a proposal for a new, quote, Trump deal, end quote, aimed at resolving a nuclear row, saying it was a strange offer and criticizing Trump for always breaking his promises. Daniel Lazar, it seems to me that a lot of these agreements and things to him are like what he does with these buildings. He doesn't own the building. He just puts his name on it. He cancels the JCPOA and then wants to negotiate a deal that really is almost like the JCPOA. He wants to renegotiate NAFTA and winds up coming up with a deal that's the USMCA that pretty much looks just like NAFTA. And with the China deal, he's got a phase one deal that, to what Jack was saying earlier, is a whole lot of stuff that China already agreed to. So to me, this is like Trump just putting his name on stuff that he doesn't even really own. And now he wants to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran? That makes no sense.
Well, my understanding is that this talk of renewed negotiations is actually coming from two places.
Boris Johnson.
Coming from the Europeans, right. France, Germany, and Britain. It's also coming from the Democrats. In fact, in this week's debate, even Sanders was talking about we should negotiate with Iran. Well, there really is no reason for negotiations because the U.S. already negotiated with Iran. And if a Democrat becomes president, I would think what they would want to do is simply to tell Iran, listen, we want to take back Trump's abrogation and turn the clock back to pre-2018 and restore the JCPOA in all its glory. And I'm sure Iran would say fabulous. And a deal like that could be done in 5 minutes. And I'm not so sure Trump is in favor of negotiations. In fact, as you remember, Mike Pompeo issued 12 demands of Iran about a year ago, which were so radical and humiliating that there simply is no way that Iran could possibly say yes to them. So I think that that Trump and his neocon advisors really still are intent on regime change, and that the Europeans and the Democrats are trying to talk about a new round of negotiations. But really, the only decent thing to do would just be to say, Trump was wrong. Let's put the JCPOA back where it was, and let's go back to the way things were before Trump threw a monkey wrench.
Actually, Daniel, I don't think it would take 5 minutes. I think it could be done in 3 minutes. Jack Rasmus.
Yeah, well, I think you put it well, Wilmer. You know, the way he operates is to provoke and make a crisis, blow it up bigger than it even is sometimes, and then settle for something damn close to what was the status quo before. And I think, what Trump wants out of this is close to the election announcement that the Iranians have agreed to sit down and discuss changing the deal. That's all he really wants. I don't think he wants a deal. I don't think he cares one way or another. He just wants to use it to show his base that, in a sense, he's, quote, intimidated Iran back to the table. Now, Iran doesn't have to negotiate publicly. It can set up a back channel and discuss, with the Europeans through the Europeans.
Switzerland, probably.
Yeah. And, that probably will occur. I think you won't hear much about it, but Iran has nothing to lose by doing that. I think this thing is the way he operates in general, and I don't think he really wants a deal one way or another unless it makes him look good, even if it's exaggerated and lied about. But nothing's going to happen except maybe a lie about them agreeing to meet as we get close to the election. Nothing's going to happen.
Jim Kavanaugh, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told Reuters that the deal was still alive. Quote, no, it's not dead. It's not dead, Zarif said at a conference in New Delhi. But he told the conference Trump's withdrawal from the earlier deal made new negotiations with Washington pointless. Quote, I had a U.S. deal and the U.S. broke it. If I have a Trump deal, how long will it last? That to me seems to be very clear signaling to the European Union, hey, I'm with you guys, and to the United States, go pound sand.
Well, unfortunately, the European Union is now acting, the three European countries, France, Britain, and Germany, are following the United States' lead and putting dispute resolution against Iran that's going to trigger those snapback snapback sanctions. The Iranian position is exactly what Dan said should be the position of the United States. It is return to the JCPOA, do away with the sanctions, we're under economic warfare. They consider themselves under economic warfare, and they're correct. And they're saying, stop all that, go back to the JCPOA. If you want to talk about other things, we'll sit down and talk about other things. But this business with the nuclear deal, what the United States wants from Iran now, what the United States and Israel want from Iran, and what they didn't like about the nuclear deal, is they want those ballistic missiles stopped. They want what the Quds force is doing around the region, which is building up local forces that have weaponry and have training and can resist Israeli aggression. That's why on the same day that they assassinated Soleimani, they tried to assassinate another Quds force leader in Yemen. Mm-hmm. This is what the United States wants. They had a deal on a nuclear thing. They want to stop Iran from building up forces that are the axis of resistance against Israel around the region. That's what it's about. And Iran is saying, they're not going to sit down with Trump to make him look good for elections. They're saying, we're not going to sit down with you unless you stop the sanctions and restore the JCPOA. Then we'll sit down with you and talk about anything else you want. But we're not going to – precisely what they're not going to do is do something that he's going to be able to use as a kind of fig leaf to show why he's got Iran to do something, to go to negotiations. So this calling for negotiations is silly. What you got to call for is go back to the JCPOA.
And I can't understand how any accusations of Iran breaching the deal and, you know, implementing a dispute mechanism, that makes absolutely no sense, since very clearly the United States breached the deal. Gentlemen, as always, thank you so much for your time today. As always, greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour. Dr. Jack Rasmus, Jim Kavanaugh, and Daniel Lazar, have a wonderful weekend. Look forward to having you guys back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. All right, folks, you have been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out!